Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation today about the idiosyncrasies of language, from French to Navajo. But first, President Bush today called on Congress to jumpstart the economy with $140 billion in tax relief, joining the call from many lawmakers and analysts to put more money in the hands of Americans to boost consumer spending. That reportedly could mean tax rebate checks of up to $800 for individuals, $1,600 for families. Congress had been considering smaller tax rebates, along with aid to the poor and unemployed. For more, we go to Zanny Minton-Beddoes. She's economics editor at The Economist. And Zanny, what are economists suggesting that Congress should do?
Well, there's pretty much a consensus amongst economists that any stimulus package should conform to three T's. It should be timely, temporary, and targeted. By timely, that means it needs to come through quickly so that people get money in their pockets to spend now. Temporary, so that it doesn't worsen the long-term budget deficit. And targeted on people who are most likely to spend the money quickly, because that's what the economy needs, which tends to be poorer people who live more paycheck to paycheck.
Well, take us through the various approaches that are set forth by different economic schools of mind.
Well, the interesting thing is that within those three T's, there is actually some divergence about exactly what the best specific policies are to get there. I think most economists say that some kind of a temporary tax cut or rebate would be a good idea. Opinions a bit more divided on whether you should focus some of that on tax cuts to businesses. That would encourage businesses to invest. But some of the evidence suggests that that you don't get as much bang for the buck quickly from that. And then there's a bit of debate about how much you should focus on doing things like extending unemployment insurance, which would be certainly a way to help people who are in particular trouble. But some worry that if you extend that, you take away the incentive for people to actually find a job. So you change the structure of unemployment insurance temporarily. It's quite hard to change it back again.
Some of the other ideas that have been mentioned are the Economic Policy Institute wants job-generating infrastructure improvements, but it doesn't seem like that would be a short-term fix.
Well, that's the thing. When these kinds of things happen, everybody comes in with their 2 cents worth and tries to push their pet idea. And some of the things that have been pushed forward, we've had, for example, some ideas for green stimulus packages, specifically things proposed to that would be both environmentally helpful and a stimulus. But the problem is it's hard to get those kind of things up and running quickly. So most economists think that the best thing to do is to get cash quickly into the hands of people who will spend it.
And what is the thinking on a check? You know, cutting a check and sending a check out.
Absolutely. I think that's what happened in 2001. There was a rebate. If you remember, President Bush had been campaigning on a permanent tax cut, but as the economy slowed when he became president and there was a desire for an economic stimulus, added to that package was a rebate check, which went to all Americans who paid taxes. And I think there's a lot of momentum for repeating that kind of thing, in fact, having a rather bigger rebate this time around.
The candidates have weighed in as well, even though they are not people who can, you know, enact any change right now. But just briefly run through some of the suggestions.
Well, on the Democratic side, Barack Obama has come up with something that it really is exactly that, a tax rebate of $250, which would double if the economic indicators continued to worsen. Hillary Clinton has come up with a series of proposals. First of all, she came out with a $70 billion package whose biggest components were assistance on home heating and for mortgage payers who were in distress, people who were facing foreclosure. She said that if the economy worsened, there would be you would need to look at more money in tax rebates, and I believe that she's now confirmed that she's looking for another $40 billion in tax rebates. But she has more proposals on the table. On the Republican side, there's been less explicit stuff.
Almost all the Republican presidential candidates want to make President Bush's tax cuts permanent.
Absolutely, and that's a very interesting issue because there was a lot of worry when this debate started a couple of weeks ago that President Bush would also have that as a criterion, that he would want to use this as a chance to make his tax cuts permanent. And that would have been an absolute red flag on the Democratic side. And one interesting development has been that the White House appears to have backed away from that.
Well, Zanny, that brings us back to the checks. Just very briefly, how likely is it that, you know, a package including checks would get through Congress? And if so, how soon might Americans see checks coming in the mail?
Well, if you'd asked me this 3 weeks ago, I would have said it was going to take an extremely long time and everyone was going to add on their own pet projects and this would be a complete nightmare. And that's usually what happens with fiscal stimulus packages. But I'm really amazed at how people are kind of coalescing, both on the Republican side and the Democratic side. So I would not be at all surprised now if something doesn't get through quite quickly. So I think we're still a few months away from the check actually arriving. but we're certainly, you know, closer than I would have expected just a few weeks ago.
Zanny Mittenbedos, economics editor at The Economist. Zanny, thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Did you know that the Star Wars character Jabba the Hutt speaks a language similar to the South American language Quechua? Or that the Dutch call verbs work words or werk words? That the Bantu language Shona, spoken mostly in Zimbabwe, has no separate words for blue or green? They both fall under the word for gray. Well, on this Friday, we thought we'd kick back a little from world events with a conversation about how people around the world communicate, the idiosyncrasies of language. Elizabeth Little is a copy editor and author of Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. She joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Elizabeth, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Robin.
Biting the Wax Tadpole?
It does relate to language. It stems from a story when Coca-Cola introduced its product into China in the 1920s. The company had to come up with a Chinese transliteration for the product name because, obviously, you can't just use Roman letters. You have to come up with Chinese characters.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, Coca-Cola came up with a great translation, which means, sort of loosely, delicious happiness. But the original characters that were used by many Chinese shopkeepers before the company introduced its official name were four characters that sound very similar. It's Coca-Cola, so it sounds just like the name. But unfortunately, when translated literally, it meant bite the wax tadpole.
Well, and this is the kind of thing that apparently you are obsessed with. How did this happen for you?
I first started studying languages when I was fairly young because my father's Canadian. And so he also started teaching me French when I was very young. I loved the puzzle of language. I loved being able to figure things out and read children's books in French. And my favorites were actually Nancy Drew, and it just grew and snowballed from there.
Well, and apparently you had a wonderful school experience and great teachers because in fourth grade, in your Latin class, you conjugated to love to the tune of a Mexican hat dance.
Yeah, and it was actually a brilliant pedagogical technique because, you know, it's now almost 20 years on and I still remember how to conjugate that verb.
Do it for us.
Amo, amas, amat, amamis, amantis, amant. And it works great for Spanish, too. So, you know, whenever I forget Spanish verbs, it's just hablo, hablas, habla, hablamos, hablais, hablan. So it works great for any sort of, two-syllable verb.
Well, you yourself have learned French, Spanish, ancient Greek, dead languages, made-up languages like Esperanto, and agglutinating languages. We use prefixes and suffixes. They do what?
Well, agglutinating languages they tack on bits and pieces to the ends of the words. It's kind of like a Lego system where you just have these little building blocks and you can build up these words of incredible length and complexity. I recently experimented with that when I traveled to Hungary and tried to get a handle on that language and failed, I might add, quite miserably.
Well, and you fail a lot, which is comforting. You begin the book with an anecdote about traveling in China and trying to order dumplings.
Oh, I was trying to ask for an English menu, actually.
Yeah.
And the word for menu in Mandarin is zai dan. I had this incredibly frustrating evening where I just wanted to eat. I was tired. I was dirty. I'd been on the road for, I think, 2 months at that point. And I go up to this lovely woman, and I just ask for an English menu in Chinese. And as per usual, as happened to me over and over again when I was in China, she had no idea what I was trying to say, because I always got the tones in Chinese messed up. And eventually, I just looked more and more desperate. And then from the back of the restaurant, I heard this woman yell out in Chinese, the huge foreigner wants a menu. And so it was simultaneously humbling and triumphant, I have to say, because at least I got my food.
Now say the word again, menu.
Zai dan. And it's that second syllable, the dan, which needs to be like a high-level tone. Because in Chinese, if you change the tone of a word, then it can change the meaning. So, for instance, for the syllable ma, you can say it in four or five ways. You have ma, which means mother, and then you have ma, ma, ma. And all three of those different tones mean different things. So you have hemp for ma, you have horse for ma, and then you have scold for ma.
It's just amazing the amount of detail you have here. You also make lists as a traveler.
Yes.
Here's one from page 24. Maltese words, I should know, so I don't look like an ugly American. Do you know some of those words?
To even find those words, I had to go on the internet and find a native Maltese speaker, because I had, you know, a number of books that made suggestions in Maltese, but they were all different. And this is something you actually find quite a bit with language guides. It's why you have to be kind of properly skeptical whenever you get your Learn Arabic in 30 Days book, because sometimes they'll use different dialects or have sort of overly formal usage. So I found a very nice man who lived in Malta and was willing to teach me how to say Yen Mil Canada, which means I'm from Canada.
Just in case. Well, here's another list. Possible entries in my series of linguistic erotica. Alveolar ejective, uvular trill. What's a uvular trill?
So the uvula, which is the little hangy thing in the back of your throat. And then a trill means that, so the uvula is the place of articulation, which means in layman's terms, that's the sort of point of contact within your mouth that you use to produce a sound. And then a trill is exactly what you'd think it is. A trill like you would use in a Spanish R, like a r, except this time you're trilling way in the back of your throat with the back of your tongue on your uvula. So I'm not even sure if I can reproduce it correctly, but it sounds like r, which is
rien.
Yeah, exactly, rien. And then a retroflex flap would be sort of if you curl your tongue in and then make a like a l noise. So like a l would be a retroflex flap.
Huh. And it gets very deep for people who want to go there. I mean, not just noun classifiers or noun declension, mm-hmm. but copulas.
A copula is a verb that connects two nouns together to sort of identify them. So if you were to say Mary is a student, then is the linking verb in there that links Mary with student. And so English makes it quite easy. We have just the verb to be. But other languages, there are multiple verbs for to be, some which indicate permanent states, some which indicate temporary states. Some languages don't have copulas at all. In the present tense in Russian, for instance, you would just put the noun and then the other noun right next to each other, and the linking is implied.
Some languages that have, you know, either died or are dying, you embrace as well. And you write about an Indian village that is trying to revive Sanskrit. Actually, there's an international move to bring Sanskrit back. But in this Indian village that is practicing it, they've had to make up words.
Right, exactly. Because when you were writing sort of Sanskrit epic poetry, you weren't exactly focused on things like long-distance telephones or laser printers or mobile phones. The most interesting thing about the new Sanskrit words is when they're created, there's often logic behind them. So for mobile phone, it translates literally as free from wire, distant voice. So Nistantu Duravani. And email, which is wonderful, is lightning message, which is pretty much exactly what we call it in English, because electricity is just lightning, really.
How do they say it in Sanskrit?
Vidyut Sandesa. So that's as close as I can get with my own Sanskrit pronunciation, which is awful. But my favorite word in Sanskrit is the word for physics, and it's Bhauta Shastra. And that means quite literally idiot science.
Well, Sanskrit speakers, feel free to weigh in on that. Elizabeth Little, author of Bite the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. We're going to have more with Elizabeth. And later in the program, we're going to take a look at this big weekend coming up in football. Some team from New England or something is playing. Back in a minute, here and now. We're back with more with Elizabeth Little, a 30-something copy editor and author of Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. She studied dozens of languages, Klingon, French, Navajo, an agglutinating language, meaning words are formed by adding onto a base, what English speakers would call a sentence. Elizabeth, you're obviously a lover of language, but how do you have the time to do this?
Admittedly, I am ultimately a linguistic philanderer. So I will spend, 2 weeks doing nothing but, say, Spanish, and I will cover my house in Post-it notes. Everything, I'll stick a Post-it to it with the Spanish word, and I'll try to think in Spanish, and I'll talk to my cats in Spanish and do all of these things. But ultimately, really nothing beats being surrounded by people speaking the language, getting to watch reality television in the language. And that's the best way to practice above all.
Elizabeth, I want to ask more about some of the things you write about. For instance, colors. Mm-hmm. Why is it that the Shona Bantu language spoken in Zimbabwe doesn't have separate words for blue and green, but they both fall under, is it Fumbu?
Pufumbu. Yeah, they fall under gray. color is one of the most fascinating parts of language, because you would think that color is a universal, you know, because it all comes down to the rods and cones that we have in our eyes. And it's true that every, you know, human being sees color in the same way, but the way in which we describe color varies drastically from language to language. There are numbers of languages in New Guinea, for instance, where there are only two basic color terms, black and white. And so every other color that's seen falls under one of those two categories. And color, I think, is such a fundamental way of experiencing the world around us that it was quite shocking to me when I discovered that every language doesn't have, you know, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. So speakers of every language are able to see all of these colors. It's just the way that they're categorized. Mm. And in Japanese, for instance, there are, in fact, two colors for blue and green. But some things that you would expect to be classified as green are not. For instance, a traffic light. You refer to that not as a green light, but as a blue light.
In the dialect of Tamil, spoken in India, there's a word for light and a word for dark, and then a number of terms that connote degree of lightness or darkness.
Exactly. Some cultures, instead of looking necessarily at the different hues, will classify colors based on contrast. It's, you know, it's all of the different things you can sort of change on your TV screen to adjust the picture. And other cultures just look at what other object around us does this color look like. So you get lots of languages in which the word for red is something like blood-like, and the color for yellow is usually something horribly disgusting like pus-like or bile-like.
Mm. Or in Dutch, the orange, the fruit, is translated into English as the Chinese apple because China was one of the early orange-growing regions. And that's part of your sidebar on orange, the
right.
color orange, that it's really a relatively new word to many languages.
One of the most fascinating things about color terms in language is you find that the evolution of color terms follows a sort of very set pattern. You're never going to find a language, for instance, that has a color for yellow without having a color for white. So at one end of the spectrum, you have languages with just basic color terms for black and white. And then the next color to be added typically is red. And so at the far end of the other spectrum is, you know, languages like English, where we do have red, orange, yellow, green, blue, and purple. But orange is one of those colors that always comes last. And so many languages that didn't have a basic color term for orange had to adopt it sort of late in the game. It was something that was borrowed from other languages or related to the thing that very often introduced the idea of orange to many cultures, which was the fruit, the orange. Hmm. So in Dutch, it's the Chinese apple because oranges were imported from China. And many languages have words for orange that are related to the word Portugal because Portugal was the main shipping power who handled all of the imports and exports of oranges throughout Europe and the Mediterranean.
There's so many interesting things. I just touched on a couple. I mean, you write that in third grade you learned, as all Americans did, that a noun was a person, place, or thing. And then you grow up and find out it's not so simple if you're studying Mohawk, which you did.
Right.
And you have the word here. Let me try this. And Iyanta Aranyantakwa, which is what is meant to define a curtain, but translated it says what?
Lace used to hang up. And what's interesting about Mohawk, and you also find this in a number of other indigenous Native American languages, is that instead of the noun being the most important part of the sentence, it's actually the verb that's really important. And many nouns you find are verbal phrases. So you'll get the barking thing, you know, instead of dog. So it's really unusual when you find a language that really focuses on a very different part of speech than we would often do.
I was so relieved to see at one point, after all this knowledge you have, that the words lay and lie still give you serious pause.
Every time I have to remind myself of childhood bedtime prayers, as I lay me down to sleep, that's the only way I can remember it. You use lay in the present tense it's the transitive verb, so you have to have an object there, or I lie down. So I lay myself down, but I lie down. I always have to think back on that prayer, or I have to actually consult my Chicago Manual of Style, which, I won't lie, happens very often.
She's human.
Well, that's the most important thing to learn about learning languages, is there's a hefty dose of humility in any language you're ever going to learn.
Elizabeth Little, her book is Biting the Wax Tadpole, Confessions of a Language Fanatic. And again, that whole wax tadpole thing has to do with an interpretation of the Chinese symbol for Coca-Cola. Just one of the little details in this fun little book. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Okay, a quick heads up on some of the stories we're going to be following next week. With 85% of Catholic dioceses reporting cases of embezzlement, Villanova University has started up an MBA program for priests. And on Monday, forget the polling numbers, how are the candidates doing in the all-important delegate count? That's next week. Still ahead today, music that asks the questions so many have asked. Why didn't the Allies in World War II bomb the train tracks to the death camps? That's still to come today, after the news, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
Les habla la esposa del senador John F. Kennedy, candidato a la presidencia de los Estados Unidos.
That's Jacqueline Kennedy speaking for her husband in the first known Spanish-language presidential campaign ad on television in 1960. She closes the ad with the phrase, Que viva Kennedy, long live Kennedy. Well, flash forward to 2008.
Los latinos de Nevada queremos una vida mejor para nuestras familias. Este es el momento de que nuestro voto sea nuestra voz. Apoyemos a nuestra amiga Hillary Clinton. Ella está a favor del seguro de salud.
Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton is running this Spanish language ad in Nevada ahead of tomorrow's caucuses. The announcer says, "We, the Latinos of Nevada, want to have a better life for our families. This is the moment when our vote needs to be our voice." The contest in Nevada, where the Republicans also caucus tomorrow morning, are being seen as the first test of Latino leanings in the 2008 presidential race. Christian Science Monitor reporter Ben Arnoldi joins us from Las Vegas. And Ben, we know that Latinos make up nearly a quarter of Nevada's population, but they only make up about 12% of the electorate, the eligible voters there. So why are they so important tomorrow?
Well, the candidates are going after any segment that looks large because the polls put this race extremely close. So everybody's looking for an advantage. The Latinos are an important segment that people are trying to capture. So is the union vote. It's just that close of a race.
Well, you remind us that Latinos also could be a key swing vote in the general election. They make up 37% of the population in New Mexico, 14% in Florida, 12% in Colorado. These are states that President Bush won by fewer than 5 percentage points in 2004. So that Latino-Hispanic vote could make that difference.
And that was one of the rationales among the Democratic Party for moving the Nevada caucus up. The idea is you would energize Latino votes here in states like Nevada, and then that would put you in a better position up against the Republicans in the general, where they do play this very important swing role.
But we're also hearing, you know, right-wing talk show hosts mocking the Spanish ad from Clinton, holding it up as a sign of how bad illegal immigration has become, perhaps unaware that Jackie Kennedy did it 40 years ago. But could these Spanish language ads backfire on either Clinton or Barack Obama, who also has one?
Oh, certainly. And when the Democratic candidates field questions about immigration or when they talk about Latinos, even in these commercials, they have to be very careful that they don't say things that may alienate the wider general population, which has been expressing discontent over the immigration, the illegal immigration issue in recent years. And so they don't want to appear to be too soft on that issue, especially with an eye to November and the general election.
Yeah. Well, we're reminded that Latinos, like African Americans, are not a monolith. They don't speak with one voice. They're, you know, split between Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, John Edwards. But are they aware, when you speak with those who live in Nevada, are they aware of, you know, the role they're playing in this? I mean, are they energized over this caucus?
Yes, I would say so. Among the general population, that is, who show up at these rallies, there's tremendous excitement. And when I go to places outside of the campaign events, I do find a lot of people have heard of this caucus coming up, and many say they do plan to show up. We'll see. Among Latinos, actually, I've noticed that at the various campaign rallies, they do not show up in the numbers proportional to their population in the state. The candidates do target the population by going out to them, into their neighborhoods. In those places, they do show up and they do seem energized. But in the general campaign stops, they do not seem to be coming out. And that could be trouble for these candidates who are relying on the Hispanic vote.
Well, and the unions are going to be trying very hard to get that vote out as well. And the unions are also not a monolith this time around. You quote Richard Hurd, professor of industrial and labor relations at Cornell, who said some unions are trying to break with labor's past. The culinary workers unions and the service workers have endorsed Barack Obama instead of the long-term politician Hillary Clinton.
Union has really split its voice here in Nevada. 8 unions have gone with Hillary Clinton, 4 with John Edwards, and then 3 went with Obama. But Obama got the most important unions in terms of numbers, and that's the culinary union, 60,000 members. That dwarfs any of the other unions that the other candidates got. So when you add up all those numbers, it's a split between where union members will go with a slight advantage to Barack Obama.
Well, for the most part, the Republican candidates are concentrating on tomorrow's South Carolina primary. Mitt Romney is the only one who's gone to Nevada to campaign there. Here he spoke about his strategy before he left South Carolina for Nevada. Let's listen.
I'm planning to get in the nomination. I'm not looking for gold stars on my forehead like I was in first grade. I want delegates.
Well, we were reminded yesterday that there are 33 Republican delegates at stake in Nevada, only 24 in South Carolina. You know, some have said Mitt Romney's heading for Nevada because Nevada is a state founded by Mormons and he's going to find at least some friendly voters there. But is he also sort of somebody who's signaling that he knows that the playing board has shifted a bit away from, you know, the white Anglo-Saxon Protestants in South Carolina to the vote in western states like Nevada?
That could be true, although it's difficult not to read his focus on Nevada as just an understanding that there are other candidates who play much more strongly in South Carolina, and he needs some win to point to, and Nevada looks like one that he can capture. But yes, the West is clearly a region that's becoming more and more important politically because of all the people moving in here. Its population has grown. The Brookings Center is working on a the Brookings Institute, I should say, is working on a research paper where they're arguing that the Intermountain West, those states between California and the Great Plains, they've grown so rapidly in recent years that they're actually becoming what they call the new American heartland, and that their political voice, their political importance is on the rise. And one of the reasons it's growing in importance is a lot of the swing states. There are a lot of contested elections between Democrats and Republicans in this particular cycle. And so both parties are going to be paying a lot of attention here.
Nevada, we understand, is the fastest growing state in the nation.
Everybody here loves to tell you that 5,000 new people move here every month. And it seems like the city's outer limits just keep expanding and gobbling up the desert around it. It's phenomenal growth. One of the things that drives that is it's still relatively cheap to live here, so you can enjoy a middle-class lifestyle without necessarily having the most high-paying of jobs.
Ben Arnoldy, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Las Vegas. Ben, any last thought there from Nevada?
Ron Paul has spent time here, too, and I think this may be the one state where he sort of does better than expected because, you know, with a caucus, it really matters how fervent your supporters are. And Ron Paul's supporters tend to be very fervent. You know, you could look for him to be a little bit of a surprise.
Ben, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
Okay, and 2 quick notes. First of all, thank you to everyone who has written. I'm now firmly in the Nevada column, not Nevada. And let's review the presidential election calendar. As we said, tomorrow, South Carolina has a Republican primary, and caucuses for both Democrats and Republicans will be held in Nevada. Democrats vote a week from tomorrow in South Carolina. That's January 26th. The Florida primary for both parties is January 29th. Maine's Republican Party holds its caucus on February 1st, followed by Super-Duper Tuesday on February 5th for voters in more than 20 states. And just a quick note, on our calendar next week, they are as popular as U2 or Snow Patrol in their home country, Ireland. We'll meet Bell X1. You're listening to Here and Now. And And it is the last stop on the road to Super Bowl 42 this weekend, with just four NFL teams left after a long season and a few rounds of playoffs. So here to talk football and the rest of the week in sports, Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Bill, have you bought, you know, feedlots full of chips and all sorts of things to sit down and watch? It's amazing.
Well, you know, yes, of course I have. I'm ready.
Well, let's start with the NFC. The New York Giants, led by Eli Manning, journey to the frigid shores of Wisconsin to meet the Green Bay Packers and Brett Favre. I know that's an ancient joke, but I can't help it. It's expected to be 11 degrees at kickoff. Remind us of the history of cold.
Well, the history of cold, as far as Green Bay is concerned, has given rise to that great and wonderful cliche, the frozen tundra.
Yes.
And the frozen tundra will perhaps be as frozen as ever this time around. What I love about this is all the players from places other than Green Bay who, in anticipation of going there, say it'll be just as cold for them as it is for us, and we're going to be really focused. We won't even notice the cold. Nonsense, say I. It'll be cold,
well,
and they'll notice.
And we remember there was the Ice Bowl in 67 when the Packers took down the Dallas Cowboys.
Mm-hmm.
You see it all the time on film. You know, they're rolling around in the snow. And then there was the 81 game at Cincinnati's Riverfront Stadium. I think that was the coldest ever. The Chargers were there. It was -9 degrees. And an unbearable 59 below.
Isn't it a great thing, though, Robin, that although we see these romantic clashes from the past as terribly important to the history of the NFL, years ago, the NFL got smart enough to always hold the Super Bowl in a place where it was warm.
Yes, that's right.
They don't want to put people through this for the Super Bowl.
So those clashes have become terribly important to the opening of NFL films.
Precisely.
Right. Let's just talk quarterbacks for a second on that side. Brett Favre and Eli Manning, a record-setting veteran versus the little brother of superstar Peyton Manning.
Right. Experience against youth and winner versus would-be winner. And Brett Favre would be the story of the year in the National Football League with his, I mean, he's going to continue, he's going to retire, he's going to continue, he's going to retire. He not only continued, he's had a great season. If it weren't for the Patriots going undefeated, he would be the story of the year in the NFL as far as I'm concerned.
Well, that Patriots undefeated has such a nice ring to it. Let's go there. The San Diego Chargers come here to New England with a, you know, real tailwind after beating the Indianapolis Colts, the reigning Super Bowl champs, but the Chargers paid a price. I actually spoke to someone in San Diego this morning on their radio station, and they said they didn't know if the quarterback Rivers was going to play.
Right. Well, he was injured, and LaDainian Tomlinson, of course, their running back, was also injured last week. Tomlinson has been practicing. Rivers says he wants to practice, is ready to go out and take some throws. I wouldn't be surprised if each of them did play. And hey, you got to give San Diego credit for beating the Colts without those two guys for most of the game last week. So, with or without them, it's a strong team.
No one here is taking anything for granted.
Certainly not Coach Bill Belichick.
No, right? Didn't he send a memo to the players
reminding them how great the Chargers have been over the
right.
last several weeks?
Right, and so I just want to quickly touch on tennis because we've been watching the Australian Open, where Justine Henin is fighting hard to fend off challengers. Roger Federer has moved into the third round. Any surprises there?
Well, Andy Roddick is out, and that's something of a surprise. And the use of pepper spray in the stands also surprised me somewhat. You don't usually think about pepper spray making an appearance at even major tennis tournaments.
What was the event?
A bunch of fans were chanting, chants that were deemed vulgar by the authorities, and so they went in with pepper spray.
Huh. Well, that's a
soccer game, sure.
Yeah.
Pepper spray is practically required, but not in tennis matches.
And finally, a note. Chess playing genius Bobby Fischer died yesterday, 64. Cold War hero when he beat the Soviet champ Boris Spassky in 72. What do you think in the few seconds we have his legacy is?
I don't think tennis will ever again be on
television.
Chess will ever again be on television. And I remember watching Shelby Lyman saying, what will Spassky do? Well, we don't know. We'll have to watch.
Right.
We'll have to see. I mean, it was the weirdest television I've ever seen, and that's the context in which I will remember Bobby Fischer.
It was notable.
Some of his personal context, not so pleasant to remember, railing against the U.S. government and anti-Semitic remarks and things like that.
Right.
But certainly carried chess a long way.
Right. Bill Littlefield, author of the book Only a Game, which just happens to also be the name of his show. He hosts it every week on NPR. Look for it and listen. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And coming up, converting train schedules and other thoughts of the Holocaust into music. That's in 1 minute, here and now. Do you remember when President Bush toured Yad Vashem last Friday at the official Holocaust Memorial in Israel? The president saw aerial photos of Auschwitz and reportedly said, "We should have bombed it." Condoleezza Rice said the president meant that the U.S. and Western allies should have bombed the train tracks used to transport victims of the Nazi regime to their death at the concentration camp towards the end of World War II. It was a question then and has been since. Should the allies have bombed the tracks? Could they have, with fighting on so many fronts? Well, now that question is also the subject of And the Trains Kept Coming, a new work from Israeli composer Lior Navak. And the Trains Kept Coming was written for chorus and orchestra. It will be performed by the Cantata Singers this weekend at its premiere in Boston. And composer Lior Navak joins us now in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
You write in the program notes, you had that question too, you know, why wasn't more done? And you began to research. What did you find?
Well, I found a lot of correspondence between different organizations and between allies, offices, British, American, inner and kind of external communications. And basically, they all dealt with the question of what to do as far as bombing is concerned. Mm-hmm. And there were many considerations that were on the table. There were many appeal letters that came from Jewish organizations, from rabbis, from church figures to some extent even, from individual people. Then came testimonies, people that managed to escape this inferno, met officials and tried to explain to them what the situation, and they met with some kind of cold answer, as if they were not exactly telling the whole truth or that they were exaggerating.
The report has earmarks of war rumor, inspired by fear and what is commonly understood to be the actually miserable condition of these refugees, who face decimation as a result of physical maltreatment, persecution, and gasping, and durable privation, allegation, and insane.
As you say, you found the slow wheels of Allied bureaucracy and some of, you know, their correspondence. You also found what you say in the liner notes is the hair-raising Nazi bureaucratic correspondence. These were the train schedules. You incorporated this in the music. Tell us how those train schedules felt to read.
It was quite amazing because I found two different ways of documenting these schedules. One was a telegram that was sent between the different people, the headquarters, the departure station, and the destination station at the camp. And basically, they would go and see a train left at 9:55 in the morning in direction to Auschwitz, and who is the responsible to this shipment, how many heads are on board, how many tracks. And basically, they would sign that. It will be a secret document. Then there were documents that kind of condensed all this correspondence into a few pages of what they called shipping plan or a weekly plan. And there you would find something more hair-raising because right below the train that carried 2,000 people would be the same train returning from Auschwitz to the destination with zero marked, which is quite scary. So when it comes to this, you know, this horror train or ghost train, it was quite shocking.
Yeah, they came back empty.
Yes.
You know, the trains kept running even as Germany was losing the war. People knew, as you write in the liner notes.
Yes.
People know.
Yes.
But Roosevelt's assistant, John McCloy, wrote in 1944 that to bomb the tracks would require diverting essential air support from other military operations. A Holocaust scholar, Michael Berenbaum, agrees to some extent. He says whether or not Allies should have bombed is a complex question, but he concludes the Allies could have used Italian or Soviet bases to do that if they wanted. What did you conclude?
Exactly. I mean, obviously, this subject is still, in a way, under debate. But the excuse for a while was that the airplanes could not reach the camps. But when, as you said, it was possible through Italian and Soviet bases, then the excuse was, as McCloy said, that the efforts should go to war. But the big question is, of course, what do you do in this case? I mean, where is the humanitarian consideration, knowing that 5 miles away from a place that, less even, 3 miles away from a place that was called the GI Farben, which produced synthetic oil for Nazi, operations, and about 3 miles away were the camps. So is it possible to drop a few bombs there, or to destroy the tracks or to destroy the gas chambers? When one reads evidences of the people that managed to escape the camp, they were actually begging for these bombs to fall on the camp.
Even so, if they were in the camp, they'd rather die by the bomb
absolutely
than the gas chamber.
Because they said, okay, our death is certain. We know that we are going to the death chamber, if it's today or it's tomorrow. If a bomb or two or three fall, it might mean that everybody will start running to different direction and people lose control. We might be able to escape. And even if not, it will mean that the next delivery of Jewish people will stop.
Why are those railroad tracks without a breach? And why have they not been blown up? Have we not sent you nearly 100 telegrams and many letters to tell you that every day, the expulsion transports travel that route?
In the piece that you've written, I'm just glancing through the book, the lyrics. There's some of this cold correspondence, but there's also prayers. I'm jumping through. In God's name, save them. In God's name, we appeal. Open wide the gates. How well are you sleeping? It's hard to read it.
Yes.
And hear it. How was it for you to put these fruitless appeals to music?
What I found is that, in a way, the music came out of the documents. They just started to speak. They just started to become notes, become melodies. And as far as I was concerned, I looked at this as some sort of a mission, as if I take these voices, and the piece is full with different sources, full with different voices, and I release them to the air. Symbolically, really, some of them were locked in files in a kind of a yellow page, and this must be brought to the world in a way again, because we tend to forget fast.
Lior Novak, his piece is called And the Trains Kept Coming. It premieres in Boston this weekend. It'll be performed by the Cantata Singers. For more, go to our website, here-now.org. Lior, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a lovely weekend, and please join us again here and now.